Greetings and welcome to It's About Florida. Mr. John Hoblick, your president of the Florida Farm Bureau. What is the state of Florida agriculture? How is the industry doing?
You know, we're doing relatively well. Most agriculture is doing relatively well across the nation. And in Florida, I think specifically, has done relatively well, despite the challenges of freezes and droughts and rains and, you know, the normal things that affect us in the natural world. But, you know, production is continuing to increase. We have strong production agriculture across this state, and you may be surprised to know that Florida agriculture contributes almost $130 billion to our state's economy annually. We have 47,000-plus producer farms across this state. We produce 300 different commodities and on over 9.2 million acres of land. Agriculture continues to be a growing commodity across the state.
You know, one of Florida's most famous commodities is citrus, Florida oranges. Everybody knows, you know, when we get the orange juice, it's probably coming from Florida. But that particular sector has struggled in years, largely due to the issue of citrus greening. And I think at one point we were at about 300 million barrels produced a year. And today we're down to about 100 and some odd million. What is going on here? And how big of a problem is citrus greening? First off, what is it? It's a bug, right?
Citrus greening is actually a bacteria that affects the citrus trees. And it affects the cell structures to where it actually makes the plant feel like it's in a drought stress situation.
Mm-hmm.
This bacteria feeds on the cells within the plant and eventually it can overwhelm and kill a tree. Several things happen to the tree in its production stages. We're seeing a drop of not only the leaves but the fruit prematurely as well. And so we're fighting a bacteria that really has yet to have a cure worldwide.
How problematic is this for the citrus industry? It brings in about $9 billion a year, but I would imagine that when you go from 300 million barrels down to 100-something million, that's really problematic.
You know, it really is, and we've got researchers all over the state and globe working on this issue and yet to find a cure. We've had a pile of money throughout the past couple of years thrown at research as well through our state legislators, the citrus industry groups as well. And, you know, we have a lot of great minds trying to work and find a cure for citrus greening. We'll get there. It's not going to happen overnight. In the meantime, our producers are pouring extra time and efforts in managing these fields and trying not only to prevent this disease, but trying to keep their plants or their trees in survival mode until this cure is found. It definitely has an impact on production, and as you stated, the 300 million to 100 million barrels. And we also find that some of that is in, or most of that's all in concentrate. And you're finding that the trends in juice production are now more fresh juices rather than concentrate juices. But concentrate still is a big, big consumer product. And then you're compounding that with imported juice concentrates from other countries, primarily Brazil. And we're seeing a more global force of competition, you might say, as well.
Let me ask you a twofold question on this issue. Because the legislature appropriated, I think, $9.5 million to go toward the area of citrus greening research. How big of an economic impact has the decrease in domestic production when it comes to oranges? How big of an economic hit has that decrease in production made to the industry?
You know, it's kind of hard to pinpoint the exact production, but when you look at grapefruits being a $181 million industry, oranges $1.3 billion, and tangerines, another 65 million as well. And you start adding these numbers up and you start taking a third of that away every year, you're going to see some significant impacts on not only how it affects the economy in the state, but of course our producers. And at the same time, the production costs are increasing for these growers just to maintain these groves. So it's compounding that. And ultimately, you know, there's going to be a supply and demand situation where citrus is going to be probably a little pricey until we can get through this situation.
Are we seeing that already? And, you know, the reason I ask this question is because I think I was watching something on one of the network stations that did a basically a report about it, and it said that, you know, Florida's citrus industry may not be viable for very much longer if we can't find a cure for the citrus greening issue. And so I'm curious about, you know, A, is that pretty accurate? Are we facing, you know, something that is that widespread and that problematic for this particular sector of Florida ag?
And you are absolutely correct. This could have ultimate devastating impacts on citrus production, not only in Florida, but in California, Texas, Arizona, where other citrus crops are grown. They're now seeing citrus greening in those crops in those states, and a collective effort. You know, this is the neat thing is you know, a lot of money's been thrown at research, which is important, but somewhere, as good as the science is today at the IFAS, University of Florida IFAS, or Florida Department of Agriculture, or U.S. Department of Agriculture laboratories, we're going to find a cure. Ultimately, what we're going to need to produce is a gene-resistant tree that will, you know, likely be the answer and one that can resist this disease.
You're listening to It's About Florida. We've been speaking with the Florida Farm Bureau's president, John Hoblick, on the state of agriculture in the Sunshine State. Now back to our conversation. We talk about, you know, agriculture as, you know, a $100 billion industry. Who are we feeding? Where does our produce go?
Florida ranks first in winter vegetable production, number one. And yes, we don't consume all the products that we produce in this state. We have, you know, a large production of fresh, winter fresh fruits and vegetables, from snap beans, squash, cucumbers, sweet corn, watermelons, et cetera, that are actually imported or exported throughout the United States. You know, we have other countries that are in lateral lines, such as Mexico, who competes with our tomato industry and competes with our strawberry industry, as well as Southern California. But by and large, Florida agriculture production is bigger than just feeding those in the state.
So who is doing the farming?
I mentioned there's probably over 47,000 farms across the state. We have everybody from small mom-and-pop, you know, five-acre organic gardens to large corporations that have, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres in production. Or, should I say, hundreds of thousands of acres. They have, you know, thousands of acres in production as well. You know, we've got a great cattle industry in this state, almost a million head of cattle that are used for beef production. It's quite a diverse state.
You know, I think Coca-Cola just recently announced that it was purchasing a couple of citrus fields.
I believe their line is Minute Maid, and Minute Maid is a big orange juice consumer as well, plus other fruits. Yes, Minute Maid and Coca-Cola have had a definite long impact in this state as far as utilizing the products that our producers produce.
You know, I ask that question because nationally we're right in the middle of a debate over immigration reform, and there has been a lot of conversation, particularly over farm workers. How have you guys worked to address this issue?
You know, immigration is a very big subject. We could probably do a whole show on that alone. But the interesting thing is that agriculture is probably one of the largest users of those individuals. I think this immigration reform is important at the federal level. We watched it develop in states like Georgia and Alabama, who actually left crops lying in the ground because they passed some form of legislation that banned these individuals from their states. And the last thing we need is for Florida to come up with some immigration law that will actually hurt the industries, not only agriculture, but the construction and the hotel and restaurant industry as well, utilize a lot of these people. And we have to find some way to account for those individuals. And I think what's being proposed in legislation in D.C. right now is a good fix. I think before you fix any issue with immigration, you have to secure our borders. That's first and foremost because, you know, we've got a serious problem at the border. Correcting that first and then moving forward to account for the people that are here, I think, is important. If we can get our Congress and our Senate in D.C. to act responsibly, we will find resolve in this and make it to where these people are accounted for, have a legal status, not citizenship by any means, because everybody has to come through the proper path of citizenship in this nation. But to account for them, allow their visas to allow them to work and contribute to our communities and society, pay taxes, and not be hiding in the shadows, I think is very important for a lot of industries, not just agriculture.
You said have a legal status but not citizenship. Explain that for me, please. Where do you draw the line, and what is your distinction?
Well, I think that having the ability to work in this country should have its benefits to people that want to come and better themselves from other countries. And that's simply what we have is a population of 12 million people that want to simply come and work in this country. By doing that, you know, they do contribute to the Social Security system. They do contribute to, you know, our taxing systems, whether they're buying food or products that are taxable and et cetera. And so they, you know, they do have some level of acceptance, which I would call those work visas, which a lot of people have earned and have gotten over the years to come to this country and work. So giving them that status of being able to work in this country, but not giving them full-fledged citizenship, requiring them to go back after a certain period of time, I think is a fair and equitable way of dealing with this issue.
When it comes to, you know, labor in the agricultural industry, we have often heard it said that we can't find any Americans who will do the work. A, is that true? How do you verify that? And B, what is the average wage of someone who is working in the ag industry?
We've become a society of being embedded into a system of a lot of handouts. When you become impoverished in the system of being able to allow the government to take care of you, you lose the desire to work. And I feel that that has contributed to the lack of individuals in this nation that don't want to work to get through and make themselves better. People, you know, utilize the system to their advantage. And it's hard to encourage them to work and work hard, and especially in the agricultural world. And there are people that are standing and willing to work, but they're not in the numbers that are there that are, you know, utilized in today's society. A perfect example of that is after Georgia passed its immigration law. They even thought, well, we'll even get our prisoners to go out and pick fruits and harvest fruits and vegetables, and even they did not want to work in that environment and felt that it was not in their best rights to do such, and so that didn't work. You know, so we have people that are willing to work, that are here, know they're not legal, but they want to work, and you know, a farm worker's salary is one that you brought up, and there's a lot of good salaries to be made. It is hard work, don't get me wrong, but you know, the average farm worker wage right now is well over the minimum wage and surpassing the $9 an hour you know, it's quite honestly a better than minimum wage environment for ag workers across the state.
Let me throw this out there, and I could be completely wrong. On the flip side, you've got agriculture, which is also heavily subsidized as an industry by the federal government. Where is the line that you draw between the person who says, I'm not going to go out there and do, you know, work in the hot sun all day for $9 an hour? On the flip side, the industry itself is being subsidized as a whole by, sure, you know, taxpayers and other people. Sure. So I'm curious about this because it's a conversation that I hear constantly, and honestly, I've never quite understood it.
Okay. Well, I think that's a perfectly legitimate question. And when we talk about subsidies to farmers, they're not thousands of dollar checks that go straight into their pocket for doing nothing. Number one, for example, a farmer who may have 100 acres of land, and his cost of putting that 100 acres of land into production may exceed $1,000 an acre just to put it in a row crop like corn, et cetera. So when they go to the bank for a loan, for example, to put in this crop, banking that they're going to have a good crop and make a profit at the end of the year, you know, they go to the bank and they say, I need $100,000 for a planting loan or a production loan. And the bank says, okay, but you got to have insurance. Well, there's not an insurance company other than the federal government primarily to help assist those farmers in those times when you have a devastation that happens. So they've risked putting $100,000 into this crop, which they hope that at the end of the day the market for it will allow them to make a profit. But at the same time, the bank says you need to carry a level of insurance, which is not readily available. So the government carries that insurance in case of catastrophic events. So number one, let's just say they have a disaster and a hurricane comes and blows down their crops and they can't harvest anything from it. The bank's assured that they're going to get their loan money back and allow that farmer, to again try and plant again next year and try all over again. And we see that across the state, whether it's drought, tornadoes, hail, et cetera, and these natural disasters have a significant impact on our producers. So when we talk about subsidies in one form, there's a risk management side, that is the insurance side of it, and then there's also freezes and things of that nature that our vegetable producers are up against, and so that's one force that has to be dealt with. The other is keeping a supply of food that's economical for our consumers and our people in this country. If we have a global glut of corn, the corn market prices go down, and sometimes below that of the cost of production. And there are assurances by the government that if the prices drop below the cost of production, that the government will help make up those differences at a certain percentage to help those farmers, again, be able to set back up and plant for the next year. If we don't utilize our farmers for production and utilize every acre of agricultural land for production that we possibly can to keep the price of food at a nominal cost for our consumers who only pay less than 10% of their average wage throughout the year on food, the cost of food is cheap in this country. And that's kind of an assurance program as well that allows for that price of food to remain a stable cost for our consumers and our people in this country. I hope that makes sense to you.
It does. Let me ask this question too, because as we talk about, you know, we're subsidizing basically everything throughout the production line. Let me ask this, maybe it's a stupid question. When everything is held artificially low, the labor and the wage is also artificially low.
Only to the level of minimum wage. Even if you're working piece rates, a farmer is guaranteeing his employees that they will at least work minimum wage or at least get paid for minimum wage. We have a cap on how low we can go in wages.
Mm-hmm. So is it rational to say maybe it's time to do away with the farm subsidy? That's also been, I mean, part of the public discourse recently, that maybe it's time to stop subsidizing.
I think that is a big concern of the American people, that they think that, the $1 trillion that go into over 10 years into a farm bill, that's what the farmers are going to get over the next 10 years. That is simply not the case. 80-something percent of that $1 trillion over 10 years goes into the food programs that are subsidizing our citizens, i.e. the food stamp program or EBD cards and SNAP programs and those in nutritional programs, is not even close to what goes back into the agricultural community and our producers. So that's a big misconception that people read into that. The largest part of a farm bill is not agriculture. It is subsidy programs for the general public.
Thank you for that. Thank you for no, I really appreciate that. I mean, because I hear it all the time, and I'm just like, what does it all mean? And I think a lot of people have that question of, what does it all mean? Let me segue a bit to another issue that has popped up in Florida, and that is the matter of Everglades restoration. The governor just signed off on a $36 million bill that the state would start putting more toward, rebuilding the Everglades ecosystem. But an issue popped up within that bill that dealt with something called the agriculture. Let's see if I can't get this correct. The agriculture privilege tax.
Correct.
And first, for our listeners, what is it? How does it relate to the Everglades restoration, and what is changing with this tax?
All right. What has happened is, over the years, there was a, quote, polluter's pay obligation in the Everglades. So if you were a producer and you had nutrient loads that were actually going into the Everglades and you were able to be pinpointed as having, excess nutrient loads, and this was back in the 70s and 80s, actually, when Everglades restoration first started. And the producers felt that, and along with the environmental community, felt that, the polluter should pay. Quite simply, they self-imposed a 25-cent per acre tax on sugar farms. I believe that started back in the year 2000 or in the early 2000s. They've been adding that 25-cent per acre tax on our farms. And what they did in legislation this year is actually extend that 25-cent per acre from 2024 to 2026. Our farmers and our science have gotten better in the past 10, 20 years, and it's incredible the work that our agriculture producers have done in the Everglades area, because actually the loads that are coming off of their farms now are cleaner in some instances than rainwater. We've gotten it down to a good science. They implement what we call best management practices. The science has even made it to where applying pesticides or chemicals or even fertilizers, they're using GPS systems to spot treat just specific areas, not the whole fields. They're only adding nutrients where needed. They're utilizing water in a more conservative way. And I think combined with that and the Everglades cleanup mission, I think this all fits together in a really nice piece that not only the environmental community agrees with, but us in agriculture as well. It's the first time in many, many years we've all been able to sit down and really agree upon a common solution that's important for everybody, and especially the Everglades.
That tax, though, I think falls to, 10% after 2026? I think another 10 years it goes from 25 cents down to 10 cents. It's
Correct.
Like a phase out. How is that supposed to work, and why not just extend it and keep it at the 25 cents? And the reason I ask is because, not all environmentalists are enthused about the deal that came out.
Well, I don't think everybody's happy totally. I mean, it's a common agreement that we came to a consensus together. But if you think about it, the next 20 years and the revenues generated, and as science continues to get better and our producers continue to strive for better environmental outcomes, I think by 2026 is a goal that they have all agreed upon, that the Everglades should be near getting close to being completed. So, therefore, the tax may not be needed at that time, and it certainly can be addressed as it comes to an expiration date. And if producers haven't done a good job like they're supposed to do, that's something that they probably need to readdress. But at this point, it's a visionary issue, and we think that as time goes on, that we're only going to get better at it. So a tax of this nature shouldn't be punitive when we're doing much better in the long term.
Well, Mr. John Hoblick, president of the Florida Farm Bureau, thank you so much for joining us today on It's About Florida. We really appreciate it.
Well, I thank you, and I look forward to maybe coming back one day in the future.
Thanks to our guest, John Hoblick, president of the Florida Farm Bureau. You've been listening to It's About Florida, a production of WFSU-FM. I'm Lynn Hatter. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance. Please join us again next week for more discussions on the issues impacting our state.